You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to Table Talk, a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters Live. Every episode of Table Talk features visionaries from across the food industry, digging deep into the latest innovations and the wild ideas that are going to change our world. And today's episode continues our series of conversations with the really big thinkers and disruptors in the industry. This one is called The Future of Protein, and we're going to find out the extraordinary story of how the biggest meat producers in the world might find themselves partnering with the alternative protein world. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, in recent editions, our guests have often mentioned a really stunning development: the approval given in Singapore to allow lab-grown meat to be served in restaurants. Frankly, it's a game changer. This is a world first. And the company behind this is Eat Just. The person behind Eat Just is Josh Tetrick. I could give him a lot more build up because the plaudits raining down on him for being one of the leading disruptors in the industry are remarkable. But really, let's just get talking because I want to learn his secrets. Where is the alternative protein revolution heading? If anyone knows, Josh Tetrick does. Hello there, Josh. How are you doing?
Hey, Steph. Good to be with you.
Fantastic. There's masses to ask, but we always like to start these interviews with a bit of a curveball. Tell me something about yourself that you've never admitted in an interview before.
I wish I was a good enough swimmer to not just like swim in an ocean, but like swim a full lagoon. And I'm thinking that because I'm actually looking at a lagoon with seals in it. Ooh. Out my window right now. And there's a guy in the morning, he's like, and he must be 70, 80 years old, who just swims the full length of this lagoon without his shirt on. And, you know, I think I'm, you know, young, fit guy, but I feel like if I did that, I would drown.
I like that. I like that. A friend of mine swam the English Channel, which is quite a long way. And there are lots of things you tackle along the way, deep down inside yourself. I'm not sure if you want to go there. Now, we're going to get onto the origins and goals of your company in a moment. But to give us a snapshot of what you're about, what is the essence of your business and what's the most exciting thing in your portfolio at the moment?
At the heart of what we do is a strong belief that people enjoy eating meat and eggs. They enjoyed it 10,000 years ago, they enjoy it today, and they'll probably enjoy it 1,000 years from now. And we need to figure out a way to give people all the meat and eggs they want without a few things. Without the slaughter of an animal, without the harm to any animal, without directing bulldozers to knock down biodiverse rainforests, without increasing the risk of what's called zoonotic disease, of which COVID-19 is. It just means a disease that jumps from a non-human animal to a human animal, and in a way that is not increasing chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease. So we're trying to build a food system focused on meat and eggs that looks a little bit more like that. And I have a 2-year-old niece, and my goal is to make that happen by the time she graduates from high school. And the most recent project that we have that you mentioned is real meat called cultured or cultivated meat. It's not plant-based, it's not mushroom-based, it's real meat, but you don't need to kill a single animal to make it. It starts with a cell and ends with a piece of chicken, and all the other stuff in between that flows from our current food system is eliminated, and we think it's going to be how meat will be consumed for the rest of our lifetimes.
Now, we've talked a lot about alternative proteins on this podcast, so it's a recurring subject. But so many people have talked about this Singapore moment. Now, I believe that's in December, Singapore was the first country to give regulatory approval for lab-grown meat, and they gave it to you. What does that mean?
So we received regulatory approval on Thanksgiving night, and then we went ahead and sold it on December 19th at 7:20 or so p.m. to a group of 5 young people between 12 and 18 years old. And we've gone on since to sell it to over 500 people. So what it means is that for thousands of years, all of us today, all of our ancestors have been eating lots of meat. But every single slice, every single bite, every single cutlet, every single pork chop, every single bit, ounce of meat has come from killing an animal. Sometimes it's in a large factory farm, Actually, most of the time it comes from a large factory farm, and some of the time it's on the end of a spear back in the day. But this was a regulatory approval that changed the dynamic of how meat is produced. It was the first time that meat that did not require the slaughter of an animal was approved. And when we went on to launch it about 30 days later, it was the first time that human beings ever sat down at a table and consumed in a commercial environment real meat without the slaughter of an animal. So we think it was a pretty historic moment in food, in meat. And although we're only going to be producing in the, you know, the hundreds of pounds this year, we think it's the start of something that will change how human beings consume meat for the next many hundreds of years.
Now, if any of our listeners aren't really aware of the alternative protein world, and specifically this part of it, which is the cultured meat area, it's been talked about. We've been talking about it for years and years. There's been a huge amount of money involved in the industry. There's been a huge amount of work done by lots of people. But there was the blockage, and which was actually starting to sell this stuff. And I don't think you can explain quite the enormity of the amount of change that this opens up. Is that how you see it, that this is the beginning of something enormous?
We do, and I think you can look at it through one of two ways. One is 500 people or so have tried meat that didn't require slaughtering an animal, yet today many tens of billions of animals are slaughtered, and we direct bulldozers to knock down over a third of our land to plant soy and corn. So who cares? It's a tiny little event. I think the other way to look at it, and this is definitely the way that we look at it, is all change in entrenched system starts with something. And we think this is the something for a larger scale change in the way that human beings consume meat. You know, it's difficult with the human brains that we all have, certainly including mine, to see how fast change can happen sometimes. I'll give you a few examples. 20 years ago, there was a poll done. They asked people, could you imagine streaming your music as opposed to buying your music? 3% of people said they could imagine streaming instead of buying. Yet today, where I am sitting here in the United States, well over 80% of the songs listened to are streamed. 10 years ago, General Motors, Ford, name your big car company, protesting, fighting, lobbying, money, trying to push back electric cars, saying it'll never happen. Yet, a couple days ago, I think for the first time, more electric cars produced in Europe than gasoline-powered cars. General Motors, a few months ago, said the only kind of car it's going to make is an electric car. The thing that seems really bizarre in the moment ends up being the thing that everyone does.
Yeah.
And it's got to start somewhere. And we think that start was at 7:21 p.m. in Singapore on December 20th with five people, 12 to 18, who sat down and they said they want to eat something different.
Yeah. I think it's the start of something absolutely huge. Now, I mean, there are people who are worried about things like this. Michael Pollan said, don't eat anything your grandmother didn't eat. And there are lots of people who say, we shouldn't be fiddling around with food. And I always say to those people, imagine the potato. Now, in the Americas, the potato has been there for thousands of years. In Europe, we've only had the potato around here for about 500 or 600 years. And, you know, somebody had to be the first person to try it. And now it's something that has sustained and provided nourishment for millions of people who might have otherwise died. You know, same with corn and tomatoes and chilies and things like that. And that I don't agree. I'm saying I don't agree with Michael Pollan. I think you have to try something your mother didn't eat, because otherwise change isn't going to happen. And change is needed at the moment. Would you agree with that?
I think the challenge is that there's much of what Michael Pollan says that I am very aligned with. I think that eating whole foods, I think eating plants, I think detaching yourself from the intensity of industrial animal agriculture all is more helpful than it is harmful. Just like I think riding a bike or walking to work is much better than a gasoline-powered car, and even walking to work is better than an electric car. But you have a big problem staring you in the face, and it's that human beings are not perfect. You know, if human beings were eating squash and kale and arugula and grapes and oranges and apples and blueberries all day, I wouldn't be doing this job. I'd be doing something else. But we're not. We're not perfect. We like the taste of meat. Sorry to say it. We like the taste of a little blood in our mouth. That is very human. And we need to figure out a way, an approach, a different approach, to allow for that craving, that desire for meat, without creating the damage that we see all around us. Now, does that mean that people shouldn't be eating what their grandmas fed them? Of course not. I want people to eat lots of things straight from the farm. I want people to eat in a more local way, just like I want people to ride a bike. But you know what? Some people want to drive to work. And if we don't figure out a way, a more transformative way, to feed them the meat that we want, I'm afraid there just won't be a third of our planet that's being used as fields and fields of chicken feed, but it'll be almost all of it. And that'd be a pretty sad thing.
I'm just going to step away from the chat with Josh for a moment because I want to mention that the protein focus continues here. We've got all sorts of incredible speakers on alternative proteins and lab-grown meats at this year's Sustainable Food Futures webcast, which is on the 16th and 17th of November and available online afterwards. For more information, please check out the website foodmatterslive.com. Okay, back to Josh. So I think it's time to blow your own trumpet now. Why is it you that got the regulatory approval in Singapore and not another company? What's put you in that position to be there when the change happens?
Well, I think there are a few things going on. So one is there are a lot of really high quality companies in the space. I think over 90 companies now from Japan, across Europe, North America, China are in the space. And I think, you know, one distinction that I think we're fortunate to have is we've been selling food products for well over 9 years. We have a product called Just Egg. It's an egg, but entirely plant-based. And when you understand how to sell food products, well, you have to understand a few things. You got to understand what's driving a consumer. You've got to understand how to scale it up. And importantly, as it relates to this, you need to understand the regulatory environment in various countries and how to thoughtfully approach it. So our plant-based egg product has been approved in China, in Singapore, in Canada, in Korea, in the US. And when you're able to get something approved that hadn't been sold before, you have to build a regulatory team. You have to understand all the elements of how a regulatory process works. You've got to understand scale up. And all of that knowledge was then put to bear on our application and how we approach regulatory for what we call good meat, which is, said simply, real animal meat without needing to slaughter an animal. And we did that in Singapore, and we applied well over 2 years ago, put together a strong application. And Singapore, like every other country, didn't have a defined program for this. So they really had to build it through the prism of our application. They eventually appointed a safety panel. They asked all sorts of important questions like, where does the cell come from? What are the nutrients you're feeding the cell? How do you scale it up? Where do you scale it up? What is a bioreactor? Can you tell me more about this? And we can get into more of this together if you like, Steph. And we had to answer all those questions thoroughly. And then after about 2 years, we received word, ironically, on Thanksgiving, that we'd gotten over the finish line, and then it was time to really go.
Now, this is a slightly tangential question, but Singapore's a really interesting place, isn't it? And by doing this, Singapore pretty much instantly positions itself as the most exciting place in the world to develop alternative protein. I mean, it sounds like a clever tactical move. Why Singapore for you?
You're right. It was a really smart move by them. The folks in Singapore who deal with foreign direct investment, regulators in Singapore have seen a rush of companies wanting to come to Singapore, a rush of companies that want to introduce new approaches to food, not just cultured, cultivated meat, but other things, because they realize that Singapore, just like we did, has a few unique characteristics. So one, it's pretty diverse. So it's got folks all across the world. You got lots of people who came from London there. You got people from LA there. You've got people from Hong Kong there. You've got people from around the world that come. So that's one important characteristic. Another important characteristic, it situates itself very much as a hub, a global commerce hub, globally and certainly in Asia. Third thing is you have a history of a country and a people that is extremely forward-thinking. Singapore wasn't blessed with oil under the ground, wasn't blessed with lots of natural resources like, arable land like in the Midwest and Iowa. And sometimes when you're not blessed with natural resources, you have to tap even more so the resources, above your shoulders. And they really push to create new industries, whether in biopharma or whether now in food. And there's an ethic around that, a pushing and creating something new. And then the fourth thing is a really interesting one, and it has to do with the fact that they are an island who is even more exposed to issues of climate change, of food insecurity. And they want to build a system, an economy, a set of industries that allows them to have protection from fluctuations in the wild world that we live in. And that then informs, the things they pay attention to or the things they don't pay attention to. And all those reasons make us pretty excited about Singapore.
Which also then begs the question, why aren't other countries a little bit more forward with regulatory approval? Or do you now see lots of other countries going, we're ready. We're nearly ready.
I think you have a couple things going on. One is, even though I've been thinking about this since I was year two in law school, I remember sitting in a constitutional law class reading a paper about how NASA was attempting to culture goldfish on long human spaceflight. And that was the first time it really came into my mind. And that was, well over 15 years ago, I think now. This is still really new for the vast majority of people, including regulators. It's really not until Singapore approved it that it moved from really feeling like science fiction to maybe this could be something that matters more in our lifetime. So I think that's one dimension. It's just really new for a lot of people, and they haven't thought about it because they haven't thought about it. They haven't designed a regulatory environment around it. But you do see, the U.S. building the scaffolding of something. You see Qatar building the scaffolding of something. You see Israel building the scaffolding of something. I'm hearing rumblings in China about building the scaffolding of something. So I think there's a feeling that this is coming, but people are still attempting to wrap their brains around, well, how fast is it coming? And I think to me, that's one of the central questions this whole thing is, not whether the vast majority of meat will be made this way in the future, because in my mind, I think it's an obvious yes. But is that future 10 years or is it 200 years? And just like the electric car, we could have had a world of electric cars 40 years ago. But for all sorts of reasons, cheap oil, consumer habit, the lack of companies really taking the lead on it, it's not until right about now that it starts to rise up.
Now, which leads me to my next question, really, which is about money. You've raised a lot of money to fund the business. Now, investors aren't really interested, I would imagine, in a 200-year lead time. It's the 10 years they really want to. But this is very future oriented. There's still not a lot of lab-grown meat in the shops. What are they thinking? Do you know what their time scale is for what are they hoping will happen?
Yeah, they're definitely not investing, thinking it'll be a 200-year time scale. That's for sure. I think what's going on is, when you think about investment capital, money goes to many different places. It goes to savings accounts. It goes under people's beds. It goes into bonds. It goes into larger scale, more conservative infrastructure projects. It goes into big companies like Apple. And then there's a slice of money that goes into bigger bets. And many of those bigger bets end up failing. But some of them end up not failing and returning in very significant ways for investors. And we're fortunate to be one of the handful of companies that a number of, whether sovereign wealth funds like Temasek or the sovereign fund in Qatar, early stage venture capital firms like Coastal Ventures or Founders Fund have decided to put a slice of their capital in. Now, they don't put the money in thinking it's certain. They put the money thinking in that it's along some spectrum of probability, knowing that many companies they invest in won't be around. Now, obviously, it's my job and it's my team's job. We have over 180 people across 14 different scientific disciplines, from food engineering, food science, culinary, cell line development, all pushing hard every day to make this a reality. It's our job every day to make it a little bit more likely than not, knowing that believing that it is certain is simply false. But what we can do, as I said, put our heads down and make it more likely. And I think some investors are comfortable with that risk appetite. You know what? Some staff hear it and they say, you know what? Happy to be friends, but I'm not interested in investing, and that's okay. Mm.
And I think, you know, you've got to be brave to make a big investment. And you know, I think a lot of people are investing to make a change these days, and which is really exciting.
That is another, yeah, I should say, to give due credit, certainly the primary motivator, because these folks are managing, for the most part, managing other people's money. We also have high net worth folks who directly invest in us. They have a lot of places to put their capital. And I think, all things being equal, if a bet has the potential to have a meaningful impact, it makes them a little bit more likely to want to do that. Because, you know, I mentioned sort of eating meat feels like it's a, you know, an understandable human desire. So is feeling meaning too. You know, people do want to feel a sense of meaning. That's also primal. And I think, you know, to some extent we benefit from that.
I just want to drop in to mention a couple of other recent editions of Table Talk, which are really relevant to this conversation. We had a fascinating edition asking, is there a future for meat? And another on the challenges and opportunities for alternative seafood producers. Both of those are in the extensive archive on the website. Check them out at foodmatterslive.com. Now, back to the interview. Now, you mentioned that various industries have in the past been slow to come forward, and that some industries have pushed back to stop innovation happening in other areas. Do you see the alternative meat space as a bit of a battleground with animal agriculture? And do you get hate mail? Do you have to argue your case with agriculture?
Yeah. There's an interesting dynamic happening in the world of large-scale animal agriculture now, in that some companies are beginning to really embrace this, invest in companies like ours, change elements of their business model to prepare for what the future is going to look like. And then you have some that are resisting it, lobbying against it, you know, shouting it down in the media. So we get both. Now, we also have some pushback on the other side. There's a, you know, a group of folks out there who don't consume any animal protein whatsoever, who think the idea of any animal flesh is somehow immoral, even if it doesn't mean slaughtering an animal. So you end up getting some pushback from groups like that too. Mm. Our approach to this is, we think that the big meat companies, ultimately, if they're to be around, just like if GM is to be around, just like if, you know, movie studios are to be around, you simply have to adjust. And they're going to take a bet how quick that adjustment needs to be made. Now, General Motors, their bet is coming a bit late in the game. There's a reason why Tesla has a much higher market capitalization than them, but good for them for coming. Some music studios have taken a bet too late in the game too, and they're no longer around, right? Because of the advent of streaming. Some movie studios are no longer around right now, or really suffered and getting blown out by Netflix at, you know, at the Emmys, the Academy Awards. So, you know, sometimes you can be too early, sometimes you can be too late. And I think it's up to all these companies to decide where they want to be in this. And we're also very open to partnering with them too. I don't look at this as a good versus evil kind of binary deal. I just want to do things that make it more likely than not that more people are eating in a way that is aligned with the kind of people I think we want to be and the kind of planet that we want to live on. And if it means partnering and, you know, locking arms with the most intensive forms of intensive animal agriculture, let's do it. I just want to solve the problem.
And also, once you've solved the problem of doing this at scale, then a lot of the challenges that you will face will be exactly the same as agriculture. You know, we're talking about structure, distribution, people, NPD, knowledge distribution, technology, fuel. You know, your company has a very different source, kind of, you know, material, but the rest of the problems are similar.
You're entirely right, and that maybe doesn't sound exciting to a lot of folks, but that is absolutely right. That is half the battle. It's the boring stuff. It's the stuff, how do you get, you know, a chicken takes from a chick to a fully grown chicken takes about 44, 47 days. Now that process of the chick and the feed and the slaughter of an animal, that is entirely different than our process. We start with the cell. We don't need sowing corn. We identify other nutrients. We don't need a chicken in a warehouse next to 100,000 other chickens. We need a stainless steel vessel called a bioreactor. And thus our process is much less environmentally intensive than the conventional process. However, once it's in meat form, it's kind of the same. You got to put that thing in a package. You got to put it in a cold warehouse. You got to distribute through a cold chain distribution network. You got to get it on a retail shelf. You got to get it on the menus. You've got to get it to larger scale accounts. You've got to deal with all the stuff that you have to deal with when you have packaged chicken after an animal was slaughtered. And these companies are pretty damn good at it, right? There's a reason why meat is so ubiquitous. And it's not just because the processing, the killing of an animal is so efficient. It's because the whole supply chain is so efficient. And the idea that we could plug into that, right, and leverage their knowledge there, I think makes a whole lot of sense. It makes a whole lot of sense for them too, because they're a few steps ahead of us in having that, and they should use it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now let's talk about the consumer for a second. Are people going to be happy to pay higher prices for this in a restaurant? Are you expecting that this will produce a product at a lower price than they pay for the equivalent meat? How do you see that working? And is it going to start off expensive and price is going to plummet? What do you see happening?
Well, I'll start with how I think it's going to look in the years ahead. I think chicken, beef, and pork that didn't require slaughtering an animal is ultimately going to be less expensive for the consumer than conventional meat today. I also think you're going to be able to eat premium meats like Wagyu or Kobe, et cetera, bluefin tuna at a much lower price than you eat today because the process is just more efficient. I think that's where we're going. I think beginning today, it is a whole lot more costly to make. And the price point is going to be much higher, 2-3 times higher for the average consumer. Now, today in Singapore, when you order it, we have a few dishes at a restaurant called Madam Fan, a Cantonese restaurant in Singapore. We have chicken rice, a chicken salad dish, a chicken dumpling dish. When you order it, it's line priced to what conventional chicken would be on the menu. So a chicken and rice dish is like $17 or so dollars. That's what we price ours at. Now, we're not making money, though. We're losing money on every sale. But to answer your question directly, I think, yes, consumers are willing to pay a bit more for it initially, just like consumers are willing to pay a little bit more for electric cars initially, underline initially. But eventually, you're going to hit a wall. And you're not actually going to solve the problem if you're only feeding people who have, you know, a college education, who are making over $200,000 a year. That is not the majority of the world's population. So ultimately, through that scale of selling to the target market, you can bring your cost down and you can bring the price down and then ultimately reach a whole lot more people. Now, that's across a much longer time span. We want the time span to be within the next 10 years or so until we're below the cost of conventional chicken, beef, and pork. If we do our job, it will be that. If we don't do our job, it will take a lot longer.
Now, just go back to the. I just want to bring us back to the places that you're working in. Now, when you look at places to work, is it where governments are investing? You talked about Qatar, and I wondered why there. Are you going to where there's money, where there's a regulatory framework that you can actually fit into? What's the draw?
It's places where we think there's a significant market. It's part of the reason we're working closely with regulators in the U.S. It's places that seem very forward thinking about building new industries. Qatar and Singapore at the very top of the list there, in part driven by, in Singapore's case, a lack of resources. In Qatar's place, I want to diversify the resources and also deal with issues like food security and climate change. It's places where there's a pretty forward-thinking mindset, maybe not with all consumers, but with certain subgroups of consumers. Those are kind of places that we're attracted to initially, but ultimately, if this is to be what we want, we'll have to sell everywhere. And there's just no getting around the kind of dollars necessary to build that infrastructure. This is a new infrastructure for making meat, at least on the upstream side. The downstream side, as you rightly said, is very similar. But from the cell to the large-scale vessel called the bioreactor where the meat is culturing, that infrastructure doesn't exist in the world today. We can't plug in anywhere. We've got to build it. We are from scratch. And that is a multi-decade, multi-billion dollar a year project that obviously we're putting our heads down and attempting to build because we think it's worth it. You know, sometimes when folks hear a 10, 20, or 30 year time span to do something like that, it can certainly be a turnoff, but nothing of consequence would have been built if people were turned off by, a multi-decade long project. Mm-hmm. Not electric cars, not streaming music, not the internet by which we're communicating over today. It takes some time. You got to be willing to suck it up and put your head down and try to get it done. Now, again, 10 years is better than 30 years, but it's not going to be tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. How would you paint a version of success? I mean, both for your company and for the concept. What if you achieved what you're planning in 10 years, how different will the world be?
So the world will be able to sit down, whether we're in London or Birmingham, Alabama, where I grew up, or in a cafe in Shanghai. The majority of the meat, chicken, beef, pork, duck, turkey, tuna, won't require a single animal to be slaughtered. It starts there. But the reason why starting there matters so much is because when you need to slaughter an animal, you need billions of them to feed people. And when you need billions of a certain kind of life to feed people, that certain kind of life needs to live on a whole lot of land and is hungry as hell. And those billions of animals need all that soy and corn to eat. So in the world that we're pushing for, not only is an animal not slaughtered, but you don't have hundreds of millions of acres of more biodiverse rainforests that are bulldozed down to plant the soy and corn to feed them. You also don't have a world that every day is making it more likely that zoonotic disease is going to create another global pandemic. You're also helping to mitigate the burden of climate change because of intensive animal agriculture is actually responsible for more climate change emissions and all the transportation sources combined. And then finally, you have a world that I think is a little bit closer to most of the values that people share. You know, we don't get most of our meat from beautiful pasture-raised farms today that people are probably thinking about. We get meat from pretty brutal places that I don't think the vast majority of human beings, even that love meat, would say that feels like me. So I think we live in a world that's a little bit closer to reflecting the best part of ourselves. Now, to get to that world, we're going to have to build large-scale bioreactors in major locations. And when we say large-scale bioreactors, I mean large stainless steel vessels, 250,000 liters, a whole lot of them, facilities that are producing 15 million pounds per year across chicken, beef, pork, and other animal proteins. We're likely going to have to partner with one or more big animal protein companies to leverage what you mentioned, Steph, the supply chain, the warehousing, the cold chain distribution, the stocking on retail shelves and getting on the menus. And we're going to have to do a whole lot of work with consumers, because we're not thinking, well, put this on a plate, the consumer's going to eat it, and that's that. One thing that we've learned in Singapore is, well, two main learnings from our consumer work in Singapore. So one is, people are a whole lot more curious about the process than I even thought. They really want to understand it. And then the other thing that I've learned is, if you're under the age of 20, you don't give a damn. The idea that your meat is made in a large stainless steel vessel is plenty okay with you, and it sounds a whole lot better than what currently is. So it's really interesting how comfortable young people are with this idea and this mindset, where you get over the age of 20, you're going to ask a lot of questions. What do you mean a bioreactor? How big is that bioreactor? What does it look inside the bioreactor? Is it genetically engineered? Is it young person under the age of 20, large stainless steel vessel, you're making my meat, sounds good, an animal wasn't hurt, we're protecting the environment, give me some more chicken.
I think it's very well said. Well, listen, I've just got one last question, really, because I mean, you're clearly driven, you're inspired, you've got the will to push this through, you're thoughtful, you've got a huge amount of dynamism. If you hadn't had your revelation in the second year of law school, what would you be doing? Would you be on a beach surfing? Have you got a hippie mentality lurking behind that? Or would you be working on some other sort of technological innovative challenge?
I might be strong enough to swim that cold lagoon like my friend in the morning. I probably would be working with kids. You know, my favorite job I've ever had in my life isn't this job. It's when I was a camp counselor. My friends listening to this will laugh. And I really like working with kids, especially kids who have been through some hard stuff in their life. And I get a lot of meaning from that, and it keeps me outside playing sports and things. I'd probably be doing something around working with kids.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I mean, what you're doing at the moment is really inspiring, and I think as you say, it's removing a blockage and starting a whole new world. So very exciting stuff. Josh Tetrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steph.
You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts, in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from food security to additions with disruptors like Paul Shapiro. Recent highlights include additions on net zero targets and food health claims. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatterslive.com. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you.